onto the front lawn, even as her 8 children overflowed the rambling house on the hill. And colts and sons and daughters and hunting dogs tagged after her as she went about the plantation. She credited her horses, especially her red mare Nellie, with human intelligence. And if the cares of the house kept her busy beyond the time when she expected to take her daily ride, she put the sugar bowl in the hands of some small pickaninny and said, "Give Nellie a handful and tell her I'll be out directly." Except on rare occasions, she always wore her riding habit, for whether she rode or not, she always expected to ride, and in that expectation put on her habit upon arising. Each morning, rain or shine, Nellie was saddled and walked up and down in front of the house, waiting for the time when Mrs. Tarleton could spare an hour away from her duties. But Fairhill was a difficult plantation to manage, and spare time hard to get. And more often than not, Nellie walked up and down riderless, hour after hour, while Beatrice Tarleton went through the day with a skirt of her habit absently looped over her arm and 6 inches of shining boot showing below it. Today, dressed in dull black silk over unfashionably narrow hoops, she still looked as though in her habit, for the dress was as severely tailored as her riding costume, and the small black hat with its long black plume perched over one warm, twinkling brown eye was a replica of the battered old hat she used for hunting. She waved her whip when she saw Gerald, and drew her dancing pair of red horses to a halt. And the 4 girls in the back of the carriage leaned out and gave such vociferous cries of greeting that the team pranced in alarm. To a casual observer, it would seem that years had passed since the Tarletons had seen the O'Haras, instead of only 2 days. But they were a sociable family, and liked their neighbors, especially the O'Hara girls. That is, they liked Sue Ellen and Corrine. No girl in the county, with the possible exception of the empty-headed Kathleen Calvert, really liked Scarlett. In summers, the county averaged a barbecue and a ball nearly every week. But to the red-haired Tarletons, with their enormous capacity for enjoying themselves, each barbecue and each ball was as exciting as if it were the first they had ever attended. They were a pretty buxom quartet, so crammed into the carriage that their hoops and flounces overlapped, and their parasols nudged and bumped together above their wide leghorn sun hats, crowned with roses and dangling with black velvet chin ribbons. All shades of red hair were represented beneath these hats. Hetty's plain red hair, Camilla's strawberry blonde, Randa's coppery auburn, and small Betsy's carrot top. "That's a fine bevy, ma'am," said Gerald gallantly, reining his horse alongside the carriage. "But it's far they'll go to beat their mother." Mrs. Tarleton rolled her red-brown eyes and sucked in her lower lip in burlesqued appreciation, and the girls cried,
"Ma, stop making eyes or we'll tell Pa." "I vow, Mr. O'Hara, she never gives us a chance when there's a handsome man like you around."
Scarlett laughed with the rest at these sallies, but, as always, the freedom with which the Tarletons treated their mother came as a shock. They acted as if she were one of themselves and not a day over 16. To Scarlett, the very idea of saying such things to her own mother was almost sacrilegious. And yet, there was something very pleasant about the Tarleton girls' relations with their mother, and they adored her for all that they criticized and scolded and teased her. Not, Scarlett loyally hastened to tell herself, that she would prefer a mother like Mrs. Tarleton to Ellen, but still, it would be fun to romp with a mother. She knew that even that thought was disrespectful to Ellen and felt ashamed of it. She knew no such troublesome thoughts ever disturbed the brains under the 4 flaming thatches in the carriage, and, as always, when she felt herself different from her neighbors, an irritated confusion fell upon her. Quick though her brain was, it was not made for analysis, But she half-consciously realized that, for all, the Tarleton girls were as unruly as colts and wild as March hares. There was an unworried single-mindedness about them that was part of their inheritance. On both their mother's and their father's side, they were Georgians, North Georgians, only a generation away from pioneers. They were sure of themselves and of their environment. They knew instinctively what they were about, as did the Wilkeses, though in widely divergent ways. And in them there was no such conflict as frequently raged in Scarlett's bosom, where the blood of a soft-voiced, overbred coast aristocrat mingled with the shrewd, earthy blood of an Irish peasant. Scarlett wanted to respect and adore her mother like an idol, and to rumple her hair and tease her, too. And she knew she should be altogether one way or the other. It was the same conflicting emotion that made her desire to appear a delicate and high-bred lady with boys, and to be as well a hoyden, who was not above a few kisses. "Where's Ellen this morning?" asked Mrs. Tarleton. "She's after discharging our overseer, and stayed home to go over the accounts with him. Where's himself and the lads?"
"Oh, they rode over to 12 Oaks hours ago, to sample the punch and see if it was strong enough, I dare say, as if they wouldn't have from now till tomorrow morning to do it. I'm going to ask John Wilkes to keep them overnight, even if he has to bed them down in the stable. 5 men in their cups are just too much for me. Up to 3, I do very well, but—"
Gerald hastily interrupted to change the subject. He could feel his own daughter snickering behind his back as they remembered in what condition he had come home from the Wilkes's last barbecue the autumn before.
"And why aren't you riding today, Mrs. Tarleton? Sure you don't look yourself at all without Nellie. It's a stentor you are."
"A stentor, me ignorant broth of a boy," cried Mrs. Tarleton, aping his brogue.
"You mean centaur. Stentor was a man with a voice like a brass gong." "Stentor or centaur, 'tis no matter," answered Gerald, unruffled by his error. "And 'tis a voice like brass you have, ma'am, when you're urging on the hounds, so it is."
"That's one on you, ma," said Hetty. "I told you you yelled like a Comanche whenever you saw a fox."
"But not as loud as you yell when Mammy washes your ears," returned Mrs. Tarleton.
"And you 16.
Well, as to why I'm not riding today, Nellie foaled early this morning."
"Dead she now?"
cried Gerald with real interest, his Irishman's passion for horses shining in his eyes. And Scarlett again felt the sense of shock in comparing her mother with Mrs. Tarleton. To Ellen, mares never foaled, nor cows calved. In fact, hens almost didn't lay eggs. Ellen ignored these matters completely. But Mrs. Tarleton had no such reticences.
"A little filly, was it?"
"No, a fine little stallion with legs 2 yards long. You must ride over and see him, Mr. O'Hara. He's a real Tarleton horse. He's as red as Hetty's curls."
"And looks a lot like Hetty, too," said Camilla.
And then disappeared, shrieking amid a welter of skirts and pantalettes and bobbing hats, as Hetty, who did have a long face, began pinching her.
"My fillies are feeling their oats this morning," said Mrs. Tarleton. "They've been kicking up their heels ever since we heard the news this morning about Ashley and that little cousin of his from Atlanta."
"What's her name? Melanie? Bless the child, she's a sweet little thing, but I can never remember either her name or her face. Our cook is the broad wife of the Wilkes butler, and he was over last night with the news that the engagement would be announced tonight, and Cookie told us this morning. The girls are all excited about it, though I can't see why. Everybody's known for years that Ashley would marry her, that is, if he didn't marry one of his burr cousins from Macon. Just like Honey Wilkes is going to marry Melanie's brother Charles.
Now tell me, Mr. O'Hara, is it illegal for the Wilkes to marry outside of their family?"
because if... Scarlet did not hear the rest of the laughing words. For one short instant, it was as though the sun had ducked behind a cool cloud, leaving the world in shadow, taking the colour out of things. The freshly green foliage looked sickly, the dogwood pallid. The flowering crab, so beautifully pink a moment ago, faded and dreary. Scarlet dug her fingers into the upholstery of the carriage, and for a moment her parasol wavered. It was one thing to know that Ashley was engaged, but it was another to hear people talk about it so casually. Then her courage flowed strongly back, and the sun came out again and the landscape glowed anew. She knew Ashley loved her. That was certain. And she smiled as she thought how surprised Mrs. Tarleton would be when no engagement was announced that night. How surprised if there were an elopement. And she'd tell neighbors what a sly boots Scarlet was to sit there and listen to her talk about Melanie when all the time she and Ashley... She dimpled at her own thoughts. And Hetty, who had been watching sharply the effect of her mother's words, sank back with a small puzzled frown.
"I don't care what you say, Mr. O'Hara," Mrs. Tarleton was saying emphatically. "It's all wrong, this marrying of cousins. It's bad enough for Ashley to be marrying the Hamilton child, but for Honey to be marrying that pale-looking Charles Hamilton.
Honey'll never catch anybody else if she doesn't marry Charlie," said Randa, cruel and secure in her own popularity. "She's never had another beau except him. And he's never acted very sweet on her, for all that they're engaged. Scarlet, you remember how he ran after you last Christmas."
"Don't be a cat, miss," said her mother. "Cousins shouldn't marry, even second cousins. It weakens the strain. It isn't like horses. You can breed a mare to a brother or a sire to a daughter, and get good results if you know your blood strains, but in people it just doesn't work. You get good lines, perhaps, but no stamina. You... Now, ma'am, I'm taking issue with you on that. Can you name me better people than the Wilkes? And they've been intermarrying since Brian Boru was a boy."
"And high time they stopped it, for it's beginning to show. Oh, not Ashley so much, for he's a good-looking devil, though even he... But look at those two washed-out-looking Wilkes girls, poor things. Nice girls, of course, but washed out. And look at little Miss Melanie. Thin as a rail, and delicate enough for the wind to blow away, and no spirit at all. Not a notion of her own. No, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. That's all she has to say. You see what I mean? That family needs new blood, fine, vigorous blood, like my redheads or your Scarlet. Now, don't misunderstand me. The Wilkes are fine folks in their way, and you know I'm fond of them all, but be frank. They're overbred and inbred, too, aren't they? They'll do fine on a dry track, a fast track, but mark my words, I don't believe the Wilkes can run on a mud track. I believe the stamina has been bred out of them. And when the emergency arises, I don't believe they can run against odds. Dry weather stock. Give me a big horse who can run in any weather. And their intermarrying has made them different from other folks around here. Always fiddling with a piano or sticking their heads in a book. I do believe Ashley would rather read than hunt. Yes, I honestly believe that, Mr. O'Hara. And just look at the bones on them. Too slender. They need dams and sires with strength."
Said Gerald,
suddenly, and guiltily aware that the conversation, a most interesting and entirely proper one to him, would seem quite otherwise to Ellen. In fact, he knew she would never recover should she learn that her daughters had been exposed to so frank a conversation. But Mrs. Tarleton was, as usual, deaf to all other ideas when pursuing her favorite topic, breeding. Whether it be horses or humans. "I know what I'm talking about, because I had some cousins who married each other, and I give you my word, their children all turned out as pop-eyed as bullfrogs, poor things. And when my family wanted me to marry a second cousin, I bucked like a colt. I said, no, Ma, not for me. My children will all have spavins and heaves. Well, Ma fainted when I said that, about spavins. But I stood firm, and Grandma backed me up. She knew a lot about horse breeding, too, you see, and said I was right. And she helped me run away with Mr. Talton. And look at my children. Big and healthy, and not a sickly one or a runt among them, though Boyd is only 5'10". Now, the Wilkes. Not meaning to change the subject, ma'am, broke in Gerald hurriedly, for he noticed Corrine's bewildered look and the avid curiosity on Sue Ellen's face, and feared lest they might ask Ellen embarrassing questions which would reveal how inadequate a chaperone he was. Puss, he was glad to notice, appeared to be thinking of other matters as a lady should. Hetty Tarleton rescued him from his predicament.
"Good heavens, Ma, do let's get on," she cried impatiently. "This sun is broiling me, and I can just hear freckles popping out on my neck."
"Just a minute, ma'am, before you go," said Gerald. "But what have you decided to do about selling us the horses for the troop? War may break any day now, and the boys want the matter settled. It's a Clayton County troop, and it's Clayton County horses we want for them. But you, obstinate creature that you are still refusing to sell us your fine beasts." "Maybe there won't be any war," Mrs. Tarleton temporized, her mind diverted completely from the Wilkes's odd marriage habits.
"Why, ma'am, you can't—"
"Ma," Hetty interrupted again. "Can't you and Mr. O'Hara talk about the horses at 12 Oaks as well as here?"
"That's just it, Miss Hetty," said Gerald. "And I won't be keeping you but 1 minute by the clock. We'll be getting to 12 Oaks in a little bit, and every man there, old and young, wanting to know about the horses. Ah, but it's breaking me heart to see such a fine, pretty lady as your mother so stingy with her beasts. Now where's your patriotism, Mrs. Tarleton? Does the Confederacy mean nothing to you at all?"
"Ma!" cried small Betsy. "Randa's sitting on my dress, and I'm getting all wrinkled."
"Well, push Randa off you, Betsy, and hush. Now listen to me, Gerald O'Hara," she retorted, her eyes beginning to snap. "Don't you go throwing the Confederacy in my face. I reckon the Confederacy means as much to me as it does to you, me with 4 boys in the troop and you with none. But my boys can take care of themselves, and my horses can't. I'd gladly give the horses free of charge if I knew they were going to be ridden by boys I know, gentlemen used to thoroughbreds. No, I wouldn't hesitate a minute. But let my beauties be at the mercy of backwoodsmen and crackers who are used to riding mules. No, sir. I'd have nightmares thinking they were being ridden with saddle galls and not groomed properly. Do you think I'd let ignorant fools ride my tender-mouthed darlings and saw their mouths to pieces and beat them till their spirits were broken? Why, I've got goose flesh this minute just thinking about it. No, Mr. O'Hara, you're mighty nice to want my horses, but you'd better go to Atlanta and buy some old plugs for your clodhoppers. They'll never know the difference."
"Ma, can't we please go on?" asked Camilla, joining the impatient chorus. "You know mighty well you're going to end up giving them your darlings anyhow. When Pa and the boys get through talking about the Confederacy needing them and so on, you cry and let them go."
Mrs. Tarleton grinned and shook the lines. "I'll do no such thing," she said, touching the horses lightly with a whip. The carriage went off swiftly. "That's a fine woman," said Gerald, putting on his hat and taking his place beside his own carriage. "Drive on, Toby. We'll wear her down and get the horses yet. Of course, she's right. She's right. If a man's not a gentleman, he's no business on a horse. The infantry is the place for him. But more's the pity. There's not enough planters' sons in this county to make up a full troop." "What did you say, Puss?"
"Pa, please ride beside us or in front of us," "You kick up such a heap of dust that we're choking," said Scarlet, who felt that she could endure conversation no longer. It distracted her from her thoughts, and she was very anxious to arrange both her thoughts and her face in attractive lines before reaching Twelve Oaks. Gerald obediently put spurs to his horse, and was off in a red cloud after the Tarleton carriage, where he could continue his horsey conversation. Chapter 6. They crossed the river, and the carriage mounted the hill. Even before Twelve Oaks came into view, Scarlet saw a haze of smoke hanging lazily in the tops of the tall trees, and smelled the mingled savory odors of burning hickory logs and roasting pork and mutton. The barbecue pits, which had been slowly burning since last night, would now be long troughs of rose-red embers, with the meats turning on spits above them and the juices trickling down and hissing into the coals. Scarlet knew that the fragrance carried on the faint breeze came from the grove of great oaks in the rear of the big house. John Wilkes always held his barbecues there, on the gentle slope leading down to the rose garden, a pleasant shady place, and a far pleasanter place, for instance, than that used by the Calverts. Mrs. Calvert did not like barbecue food, and declared that the smells remained in the house for days, so her guests always sweltered on a flat, unshaded spot a quarter of a mile from the house. But John Wilkes, famed throughout the state for his hospitality, really knew how to give a barbecue. The long trestled picnic tables, covered with the finest of the Wilkes linen, always stood under the thickest shade, with backless benches on either side. And chairs, hassocks, and cushions from the house were scattered about the glade for those who did not fancy the benches. At a distance great enough to keep the smoke away from the guests were the long pits where the meats cooked and the huge iron washpots from which the succulent odors of barbecue sauce and Brunswick stew floated. Mr. Wilkes always had at least a dozen darkies busy running back and forth, with trays to serve the guests. Over behind the barns there was always another barbecue pit, where the house servants and the coachmen and maids of the guests had their own feast of hoe cakes and yams and chitlins, that dish of hog entrails so dear to Negro hearts, and in season, watermelons enough to satiate. As the smell of crisp, fresh pork came to her, Scarlet wrinkled her nose appreciatively, hoping that by the time it was cooked she would feel some appetite. As it was, she was so full of food and so tightly laced that she feared every moment she was going to belch. That would be fatal, as only old men and very old ladies could belch without fear of social disapproval. They topped the rise, and the White House reared its perfect symmetry before her. Tall of columns, wide of verandas, flat of roof, beautiful as a woman is beautiful, who is so sure of her charm that she can be generous and gracious to all. Scarlet loved Twelve Oaks, even more than Tara, for it had a stately beauty, a mellowed dignity that Gerald's house did not possess. The wide, curving driveway was full of saddle horses and carriages, and guests alighting and calling greetings to friends. Grinning Negroes, excited as always at a party, were leading the animals to the barnyard to be unharnessed and unsaddled for the day. Swarms of children, black and white, ran yelling about the newly green lawn, playing hopscotch and tag, and boasting how much they were going to eat. The wide hall, which ran from front to back of the house, was swarming with people, and as the O'Hara carriage drew up at the front steps, Scarlet saw girls in crinolines, bright as butterflies, going up and coming down the stairs from the second floor, arms about each other's waists, stopping to lean over the delicate handrail of the banisters, laughing and calling to young men in the hall below them. Through the open French windows, she caught glimpses of the older women seated in the drawing-room, sedate in dark silks as they sat fanning themselves, and talking of babies and sicknesses, and who had married whom and why.
The Wilkes butler, Tom, was hurrying through the halls, a silver tray in his hands, bowing and grinning, as he offered tall glasses to young men in fawn and grey trousers and fine ruffled linen shirts. The sunny front veranda was thronged with guests. Yes, the whole county was here, thought Scarlet. The four Tarleton boys and their father leaned against the tall columns, the twins Stuart and Brent side by side, inseparable, as usual, Boyd and Tom with their father, James Tarleton. Mr. Calvert was standing close by the side of his Yankee wife, who even after 15 years in Georgia never seemed to quite belong anywhere. Everyone was very polite and kind to her, because he felt sorry for her. But no one could forget that she had compounded her initial error of birth by being the governess of Mr. Calvert's children. The two Calvert boys, Rayford and Cade, were there with their dashing blonde sister, Kathleen, teasing the dark-faced Joe Fontaine and Sally Monroe, his pretty bride-to-be. Alex and Tony Fontaine were whispering in the ears of Dimity Monroe and sending her into gales of giggles. There were families from as far as Lovejoy, 10 miles away, and from Fayetteville and Jonesboro, a few even from Atlanta and Macon. The house seemed bursting with a crowd, and a ceaseless babble of talking and laughter and giggles and shrill feminine squeaks and screams rose and fell. On the porch steps stood John Wilkes, silver-haired, erect, radiating the quiet charm and hospitality that was as warm and never-failing as the sun of Georgia summer. Beside him, Honey Wilkes, so called because she indiscriminately addressed everyone from her father to the field hands by that endearment, fidgeted and giggled as she called greetings to the arriving guests. Honey's nervously obvious desire to be attractive to every man in sight contrasted sharply with her father's poise. And Scarlet had the thought that perhaps there was something in what Mrs. Tarleton said after all. Certainly the Wilkes men got the family looks. The thick, deep gold lashes that set off the grey eyes of John Wilkes and Ashley were sparse and colorless in the faces of Honey and her sister India. Honey had the odd, lashless look of a rabbit, and India could be described by no other word than plain. India was nowhere to be seen. But Scarlet knew she probably was in the kitchen giving final instructions to the servants. Poor India, thought Scarlet. She's had so much trouble keeping house since her mother died that she's never had the chance to catch any beau except Stuart Tarleton. And it certainly wasn't my fault if he thought I was prettier than she. John Wilkes came down the steps to offer his arm to Scarlet. As she descended from the carriage, she saw Sue Ellen smirk and knew that she must have picked out Frank Kennedy in the crowd. "If I couldn't catch a better beau than that old maid in breeches," she thought contemptuously, as she stepped to the ground and smiled her thanks to John Wilkes. Frank Kennedy was hurrying to the carriage to assist Sue Ellen, and Sue Ellen was bridling in a way that made Scarlet want to slap her. Frank Kennedy might own more land than anyone in the county, and he might have a very kind heart, but these things counted for nothing against the fact that he was 40 slight and nervous and had a thin ginger-colored beard and an old maidish, fussy way about him. However, remembering her plan, Scarlet smothered her contempt and cast such a flashing smile of greeting at him that he stopped short, his arm outheld to Sue Ellen, and goggled at Scarlet in pleased bewilderment. Scarlet's eyes searched the crowd for Ashley, even while she made pleasant small talk with John Wilkes. But he was not on the porch. There were cries of greeting from a dozen voices, and Stuart and Brent Tarleton moved toward her. The Monroe girls rushed up to exclaim over her dress, and she was speedily the center of a circle of voices that rose higher and higher in efforts to be heard above the din. But where was Ashley? And Melanie, and Charles. She tried not to be obvious as she looked about and peered down the hall into the laughing group inside. As she chattered and laughed and cast quick glances into the house and the yard, her eyes fell on a stranger, standing alone in the hall, staring at her in a cool, impertinent way that brought her up sharply with a mingled feeling of feminine pleasure that she had attracted a man, and an embarrassed sensation that her dress was too low in the bosom. He looked quite old, at least 35. He was a tall man and powerfully built. Scarlet thought she had never seen a man with such wide shoulders, so heavy with muscles, almost too heavy for gentility. When her eye caught his, he smiled, showing animal white teeth below a close-clipped black moustache. He was dark of face, swarthy as a pirate, and his eyes were as bold and black as any pirate's appraising a galleon to be scuttled or a maiden to be ravished. There was a cool recklessness in his face and a cynical humor in his mouth as he smiled at her, and Scarlet caught her breath. She felt that she should be insulted by such a look and was annoyed with herself because she did not feel insulted. She did not know who he could be. But there was undeniably a look of good blood in his dark face. It showed in the thin hawk nose over the full red lips, the high forehead, and the wide-set eyes. She dragged her eyes away from his without smiling back, and he turned as someone called,
Rhett Butler, come here. I want you to meet the most hard-hearted girl in Georgia.
Rhett Butler. The name had a familiar sound, somehow connected with something pleasantly scandalous. But her mind was on Ashley, and she dismissed the thought.
I must run upstairs and smooth my hair, she told Stuart and Brent, who were trying to get her cornered from the crowd. You boys wait for me and don't run off with any other girl, or I'll be furious. She could see that Stuart was going to be difficult to handle today if she flirted with anyone else. He had been drinking, and wore the arrogant, looking-for-a-fight expression that she knew from experience meant trouble. She paused in the hall to speak to friends and to greet India, who was emerging from the back of the house, her hair untidy and tiny beads of perspiration on her forehead. Poor India. It would be bad enough to have pale hair and eyelashes and a jutting chin that meant a stubborn disposition, without being 20 years old and an old maid in the bargain. She wondered if India resented very much her taking Stuart away from her. Lots of people said she was still in love with him, but then you could never tell what a Wilkes was thinking about. If she did resent it, she never gave any sign of it, treating Scarlet with the same slightly aloof, kindly courtesy she had always shown her. Scarlet spoke pleasantly to her and started up the wide stairs. As she did, a shy voice behind her called her name, and, turning, she saw Charles Hamilton. He was a nice-looking boy with a riot of soft brown curls on his white forehead, and eyes as deep brown, as clean and as gentle as a collie dog's. He was well turned out in mustard-colored trousers and black coat, and his pleated shirt was topped by the widest and most fashionable of black cravats. A faint blush was creeping over his face as she turned, for he was timid with girls. Like most shy men, he greatly admired airy, vivacious, always-at-ease girls like Scarlet. She had never given him more than perfunctory courtesy before, and so the beaming smile of pleasure with which she greeted him, and the two hands outstretched to his, almost took his breath away. "Why, Charles Hamilton, you handsome old thing, you. I'll bet you came all the way down here from Atlanta just to break my poor heart."
Charles almost stuttered with excitement, holding her warm little hands in his and looking into the dancing green eyes. This was the way girls talked to other boys, but never to him. He never knew why, but girls always treated him like a younger brother and were very kind, but never bothered to tease him. He had always wanted girls to flirt and frolic with him as they did with boys much less handsome and less endowed with this world's goods than he. But on the few occasions when this had happened, he could never think of anything to say, and he suffered agonies of embarrassment at his dumbness. Then he lay awake at night thinking of all the charming gallantries he might have employed. But he rarely got a second chance, for the girls left him alone after a trial or two. Even with Honey, with whom he had an unspoken understanding of marriage when he came into his property next fall, he was diffident and silent. At times, he had an ungallant feeling that Honey's coquetries and proprietary airs were no credit to him, for she was so boy-crazy, he imagined she would use them on any man who gave her the opportunity. Charles was not excited over the prospect of marrying her, for she stirred in him none of the emotions of wild romance that his beloved books had assured him were proper for a lover. He had always yearned to be loved by some beautiful, dashing creature, full of fire and mischief. And here was Scarlett O'Hara, teasing him about breaking her heart. He tried to think of something to say, and couldn't. And silently he blessed her, because she kept up a steady chatter which relieved him of any necessity for conversation. It was too good to be true.
"Now you wait right here till I come back, for I want to eat barbecue with you. And don't you go off philandering with those other girls, because I'm mighty jealous,"
came the incredible words from red lips with a dimple on each side, and briskly black lashes swept demurely over green eyes. "I won't," he finally managed to breathe, never dreaming that she was thinking he looked like a calf waiting for the butcher. Tapping him lightly on the arm with her folded fan, she turned to start up the stairs, and her eyes again fell on the man called Rhett Butler, who stood alone a few feet away from Charles. Evidently he had overheard the whole conversation, for he grinned up at her as maliciously as a tomcat, and again his eyes went over her in a gaze totally devoid of the deference she was accustomed to.
"God's nightgown," said Scarlett to herself in indignation, using Gerald's favorite oath. "He looks as if he knew what I looked like without my shimmy." And tossing her head, she went up the steps. In the bedroom, where the wraps were laid, she found Kathleen Calvert preening before the mirror and biting her lips to make them look redder. There were fresh roses in her sash that matched her cheeks, and her cornflower-blue eyes were dancing with excitement.
"Kathleen," said Scarlett, trying to pull the corsage of her dress higher. "Who is that nasty man downstairs named Butler?"
"My dear, don't you know?" whispered Kathleen excitedly. "A weather eye on the next room where Dilsey and the Wilkes girls' mammy were gossiping. I can't imagine how Mr. Wilkes must feel having him here, but he was visiting Mr. Kennedy in Jonesboro, something about buying cotton, and of course Mr. Kennedy had to bring him along with him. He couldn't just go off and leave him."
"What is the matter with him?"
"My dear, he isn't received."
"Not really?"
"No."
Scarlett digested this in silence, for she had never before been under the same roof with anyone who was not received. It was very exciting.
"What did he do?"
"Oh, Scarlett, he has the most terrible reputation. His name is Rhett Butler, and he's from Charleston, and his folks are some of the nicest people there, but they won't even speak to him. Caro Rhett told me about him last summer. He isn't any kin to her family, but she knows all about him. Everybody does. He was expelled from West Point, imagine, and for things too bad for Caro to know. And then there was that business about the girl he didn't marry.
Do tell me."
"Darling, don't you know anything?
Caro told me all about it last summer, and her mama would die if she thought Caro even knew about it. Well, this Mr. Butler took a Charleston girl out buggy riding. I never did know who she was, but I've got my suspicions. She couldn't have been very nice, or she wouldn't have gone out with him in the late afternoon without a chaperone. And, my dear, they stayed out nearly all night and walked home finally, saying the horse had run away and smashed the buggy, and they had gotten lost in the woods. And guess what? I can't guess. Tell me, said Scarlett enthusiastically, hoping for the worst. He refused to marry her the next day. Oh, said Scarlett, her hopes dashed. He said he hadn't, done anything to her, and he didn't see why he should marry her. And, of course, her brother called him out, and Mr. Butler said he'd rather be shot than marry a stupid fool. And so they fought a duel, and Mr. Butler shot the girl's brother, and he died. And Mr. Butler had to leave Charleston, and now nobody receives him. Finished Kathleen triumphantly, and just in time, for Dilsey came back into the room to oversee the toilette of her charge.
"Did she have a baby?"
whispered Scarlett in Kathleen's ear. Kathleen shook her head violently. "But she was ruined just the same," she hissed back.
"I wish I had gotten Ashley to compromise me," thought Scarlett suddenly. "He'd be too much of a gentleman not to marry me. But somehow, unbidden, she had a feeling of respect for Rhett Butler, for refusing to marry a girl who was a fool."
Scarlett sat on a high rosewood ottoman, under the shade of a huge oak in the rear of the house, her flounces and ruffles billowing about her, and 2 inches of green morocco slippers, all that a lady could show and still remain a lady, peeping from beneath them. She had a scarcely touched plate in her hands, and 7 cavaliers about her. The barbecue had reached its peak, and the warm air was full of laughter and talk, the click of silver on porcelain, and the rich heavy smells of roasting meats and redolent gravies. Occasionally, when the slight breeze veered, puffs of smoke from the long barbecue pits floated over the crowd, and were greeted with squeals of mock dismay from the ladies, and violent flappings of palmetto fans. Most of the young ladies were seated with partners on the long benches that faced the tables, but Scarlett, realizing that a girl has only 2 sides, and only 1 man can sit on each of these sides, had elected to sit apart so she could gather about her as many men as possible. Under the arbor sat the married women, their dark dresses decorous notes in the surrounding color and gaiety. Matrons, regardless of their ages, always grouped together apart from the bright-eyed girls, beaux, and laughter, for there were no married belles in the South. From Grandma Fontaine, who was belching frankly with the privilege of her age, to 17-year-old Alice Munro, struggling against the nausea of a first pregnancy, they had their heads together in the endless genealogical and obstetrical discussions that made such gatherings very pleasant and instructive affairs. Casting contemptuous glances at them, Scarlett thought that they looked like a clump of fat crows. Married women never had any fun. It did not occur to her that if she married Ashley, she would automatically be relegated to arbors and front parlors with staid matrons in dull silks, as staid and dulled as they, and not a part of the fun and frolicking. Like most girls, her imagination carried her just as far as the altar and no further. Besides, she was too unhappy now to pursue an abstraction. She dropped her eyes to her plate and nibbled daintily on a beaten biscuit with an elegance and an utter lack of appetite that would have won Mammy's approval. For all that she had a superfluity of beaux, she had never been more miserable in her life. In some way that she could not understand, her plans of last night had failed utterly so far as Ashley was concerned. She had attracted other beaux by the dozens, but not Ashley, and all the fears of yesterday afternoon were sweeping back upon her, making her heart beat fast, and then slow, and color flame and whiten in her cheeks. Ashley had made no attempt to join the circle about her. In fact, she had not had a word alone with him since arriving, or even spoken to him since their first greeting. He had come forward to welcome her when she came into the back garden, but Melanie had been on his arm then. Melanie, who hardly came up to his shoulder. She was a tiny, frailly built girl, who gave the appearance of a child masquerading in her mother's enormous hoop skirts. An illusion that was heightened by the shy, almost frightened look in her two large brown eyes. She had a cloud of curly dark hair which was so sternly repressed beneath its net that no vagrant tendrils escaped. And this dark mass, with its long widow's peak, accentuated the heart shape of her face. Too wide across the cheekbones, too pointed at the chin, it was a sweet, timid face, but a plain face. And she had no feminine tricks of allure to make observers forget its plainness. She looked and was as simple as earth, as good as bread, as transparent as spring water. But for all her plainness of feature and smallness of stature, there was a sedate dignity about her movements that was oddly touching, and far older than her 17 years. Her grey organdy dress, with its cherry-coloured satin sash, disguised with its billows and ruffles how childishly undeveloped her body was, and the yellow hat with long cherry streamers made her creamy skin glow. Her heavy ear-bobs, with their long gold fringe hung down from loops of tidily netted hair, swinging close to her brown eyes, eyes that had the still gleam of a forest pool in winter when brown leaves shine up through quiet water. She had smiled with timid liking when she greeted Scarlet and told her how pretty her green dress was. And Scarlet had been hard put to be even civil in reply, so violently did she want to speak alone with Ashley. Since then, Ashley had sat on a stool at Melanie's feet, apart from the other guests, and talked quietly with her, smiling the slow, drowsy smile that Scarlet loved. What made matters worse was that under his smile a little sparkle had come into Melanie's eyes, so that even Scarlet had to admit that she looked almost pretty. As Melanie looked at Ashley, her plain face lit up as with an inner fire, for if ever a loving heart showed itself upon a face, it was showing now on Melanie Hamilton's. Scarlet tried to keep her eyes from these two, but could not. And after each glance, she redoubled her gaiety with her cavaliers, laughing, saying daring things, teasing, tossing her head at their compliments until her earrings danced. She said fiddle-de-dee many times, declared that the truth wasn't in any of them, and vowed that she'd never believe anything any man told her. But Ashley did not seem to notice her at all. He only looked up at Melanie and talked on, and Melanie looked down at him with an expression that radiated the fact that she belonged to him. So, Scarlet was miserable. To the outward eye, never had a girl less cause to be miserable. She was undoubtedly the belle of the barbecue, the center of attention. The furore she was causing among the men, coupled with the heart-burnings of the other girls, would have pleased her enormously at any other time. Charles Hamilton, emboldened by her notice, was firmly planted on her right, refusing to be dislodged by the combined efforts of the Tarleton twins. He held her fan in one hand and his untouched plate of barbecue in the other, and stubbornly refused to meet the eyes of Honey, who seemed on the verge of an outburst of tears. Cade lounged gracefully on her left, plucking at her skirt to attract her attention, and staring up with smoldering eyes at Stuart. Already the air was electric between him and the twins, and rude words had passed. Frank Kennedy fussed about like a hen with one chick, running back and forth from the shade of the oak to the tables to fetch dainties to tempt Scarlet. as if there were not a dozen servants there for that purpose. As a result, Sue Ellen's sullen resentment had passed beyond the point of ladylike concealment, and she glowered at Scarlet. Small Corrine could have cried because, for all Scarlet's encouraging words that morning, Brent had done no more than say, "Hello, sis," and jerk her hair ribbon before turning his full attention to Scarlet. Usually he was so kind and treated her with a careless deference that made her feel grown up, and Corrine secretly dreamed of the day when she would put her hair up and her skirts down and receive him as a real beau. And now it seemed that Scarlet had him. The Monroe girls were concealing their chagrin at the defection of the swarthy Fontaine boys, but they were annoyed at the way Tony and Alex stood about the circle, jockeying for a position near Scarlet should any of the others arise from their places. They telegraphed their disapproval of Scarlet's conduct to Hetty Tarleton by delicately raised eyebrows. Fast was the only word for Scarlet. Simultaneously, the three young ladies raised lacy parasols, said they had had quite enough to eat, thank you, and, laying light fingers on the arms of the men nearest them, clamored sweetly to see the rose garden, the spring, and the summer house. This strategic retreat in good order was not lost on a woman present or observed by a man. Scarlet giggled as she saw three men dragged out of the line of her charms to investigate landmarks familiar to the girls from childhood, and cut her eye sharply to see if Ashley had taken note. But he was playing with the ends of Melanie's sash and smiling up at her. Pain twisted Scarlet's heart. She felt that she could claw Melanie's ivory skin till the blood ran, and take pleasure in doing it. As her eyes wandered from Melanie, she caught the gaze of Rhett Butler, who was not mixing with the crowd but standing apart talking to John Wilkes. He had been watching her, and when she looked at him, he laughed outright. Scarlet had an uneasy feeling that this man who was not received was the only one present who knew what lay behind her wild gaiety, and that it was affording him sardonic amusement. She could have clawed him with pleasure, too. "If I can just live through this barbecue till this afternoon," she thought, "all the girls will go upstairs to take naps to be fresh for tonight, and I'll stay downstairs and get to talk to Ashley. Surely he must have noticed how popular I am." She soothed her heart with another hope. "Of course, he has to be attentive to Melanie, because, after all, she is his cousin, and she isn't popular at all. And if he didn't look out for her, she'd just be a wallflower." She took new courage at this thought and redoubled her efforts in the direction of Charles, whose brown eyes glowed down eagerly at her. It was a wonderful day for Charles, a dream day, and he had fallen in love with Scarlet with no effort at all. Before this new emotion, honey receded into a dim haze. Honey was a shrill-voiced sparrow, and Scarlet a gleaming hummingbird. She teased him and favored him, and asked him questions and answered them herself, so that he appeared very clever without having to say a word. The other boys were puzzled and annoyed by her obvious interest in him, for they knew Charles was too shy to hitch two consecutive words together, and politeness was being severely strained to conceal their growing rage. Everyone was smoldering, and it would have been a positive triumph for Scarlet, except for Ashley. When the last forkful of pork and chicken and mutton had been eaten, Scarlet hoped the time had come when Indy would rise and suggest that the ladies retire to the house. It was 2 o'clock, and the sun was warm overhead. But India, wearied with the 3-day preparations for the barbecue, was only too glad to remain sitting beneath the arbor, shouting remarks to a deaf old gentleman from Fayetteville. A lazy somnolence descended on the crowd. The negroes idled about, clearing the long tables on which the food had been laid. The laughter and talking became less animated, and groups here and there fell silent. All were waiting for their hostess to signal the end of the morning's festivities.
Palmetto fans were wagging more slowly, and several gentlemen were nodding from the heat and overloaded stomachs. The barbecue was over, and all were content to take their ease while sun was at its height. In this interval between the morning party and the evening's ball, they seemed a placid, peaceful lot. Only the young men retained the restless energy which had filled the whole throng a short while before. Moving from group to group, drawling in their soft voices, they were as handsome as blooded stallions and as dangerous. The languor of midday had taken hold of the gathering, but underneath lurked tempers that could rise to killing heights in a second and flare out as quickly. Men and women, they were beautiful and wild. All a little violent under their pleasant ways, and only a little tamed. Some time dragged by while the sun grew hotter, and Scarlet and others looked again toward India. Conversation was dying out when, in the lull, everyone in the grove heard Gerald's voice raised in furious accents. Standing some little distance away from the barbecue tables, he was at the peak of an argument with John Wilkes.
"God's nightgown, man! Pray for a peaceable settlement with the Yankees! After we've fired on the rascals at Fort Sumter! Peaceable! The South should show by arms that she cannot be insulted, and that she is not leaving the Union by the Union's kindness, but by her own strength!"
"Oh, my God!" thought Scarlet. "He's done it. Now we'll all sit here till midnight."
In an instant, the somnolence had fled from the lounging throng, and something electric went snapping through the air. The men sprang from benches and chairs, arms in wide gestures, voices clashing for the right to be heard above other voices. There had been no talk of politics or impending war all during the morning, because of Mr. Wilkes' request that the lady should not be bored. But now Gerald had bawled the words Fort Sumter, and every man present forgot his host's admonition.
"Of course we'll fight. Yankee thieves. We could lick 'em in a month. Why, one Southerner can lick 20 Yankees. Teach 'em a lesson they won't soon forget. Peaceably? They won't let us go in peace. No. Look how Mr. Lincoln insulted our commissioners. Yes, kept them hanging around for weeks, swearing he'd have Sumter evacuated. They want war. We'll make them sick of war."
And above all the voices, Gerald's boomed. All Scarlet could hear was, "States' rights, by God!" shouted over and over. Gerald was having an excellent time, but not his daughter. Secession, war. These words long since had become acutely boring to Scarlet from much repetition. But now she hated the sound of them, for they meant that the men would stand there for hours haranguing one another, and she would have no chance to corner Ashley. Of course there would be no war, and the men all knew it. They just loved to talk and hear themselves talk. Charles Hamilton had not risen with the others, and, finding himself comparatively alone with Scarlet, he leaned closer and, with the daring born of new love, whispered a confession.
"Miss O'Hara, I had already decided that, if we did fight, I'd go over to South Carolina and join a troop there. It's said that Mr. Wade Hampton is organizing a cavalry troop, and, of course, I would want to go with him. He's a splendid person, and was my father's best friend."
Scarlet thought, "What am I supposed to do, give three cheers?" For Charles's expression showed that he was bearing his heart's secrets to her. She could think of nothing to say, and so merely looked at him, wondering why men were such fools as to think women interested in such matters. He took her expression to mean stunned approbation, and went on rapidly, daringly.
"If I went, would you be sorry, Miss O'Hara?"
"I should cry into my pillow every night," said Scarlet, meaning to be flippant, but he took the statement at face value and went red with pleasure. Her hand was concealed in the folds of her dress, and he cautiously wormed his hand to it and squeezed it, overwhelmed at his own boldness and at her acquiescence.